Hi, biohackers, and welcome back to the Biohackers Podcast. I'm your co-host, David James Clark IV, here with the esteemed Alex Feltus Esquire. How you doing today, Alex?
An Esquire. Thank you. Yeah. I'm doing great. I'm excited. This is my all the podcasts are exciting, but this is one of my the one I have the most anticipation for.
Oh, fantastic. Well, in that case, cue the opening theme. All right. We always love, I can never get enough of that opening theme. So just before we talked about, this is one of the podcasts that you're the most excited about. I know Courtney Shearer is a former student and someone who's had a really interesting road. She's going to be sharing with us, you know, her transition, her path from being an undergraduate to industry and then, you know, to her PhD. What is it that you're excited about in today's conversation?
I think it's more of like Courtney, somebody that taught me a lot about the whole hackathon concept, because it was more classical teaching, you know, in the past. And I now move to more, you know, hybrid, you know, digital virtual delivery and trying to blend together research with the teaching and really removing the gap between research and education. I think that should just go away and it all should be democratized. And then all of our problems as a species will go away. So this is Courtney got me on the path through the creation of hackathons at Clemson University that she built. Really just taught me what's possible, and I still have no idea how far we can go with this. That what we're doing at Praxis AI.
Yeah, I really like what you said about trying to meld together training, research, you know, the hackathon as an event, but not a, you know, one and done kind of event, but more of a perpetual event. I've had personally some interesting experiences with hackathons. I just did a learning kind of technology hackathon at the end of last year. It was a hybrid hackathon. The thing that excited me about this one was we were all together in Orlando. There was, I think, five teams. You had those professional hackers, you know, come in with their kit, you know, and they were hunkered in for the 48 hours or so. But our team had a virtual member from India who would come in through the Praxis AI platform. And we built a really interesting application for emergency response and certifying and training volunteers at the moment of need and using drones for footage and all sorts of, you know, interesting technologies coming together and getting integrated into an emergency response website. I think we ended up getting second place to a talking blender or something. But anyway, I'm not bitter about it. But it was a really
literally a talking blender.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I want to buy one of those. Your thing was cool, but where do I get the talking blender?
Yeah, exactly. But what a cool experience, you know, collaborating together both virtually and in person to solve a particular problem in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
And then present it to a bunch of judges. That's an interesting experience in and of itself. Tell us about, you know, some of your favorite hackathon experiences.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you say that. I've been a judge at almost all the hackathons I've been at. I've been at some, you know, hackathons in Silicon Valley for, you know, with Bill Passman, actually working on his understanding his condition. And we've had, you know, a hackathon through Praxis AI with him. I've been through lots of hackathons at Clemson where I was a judge, and I have yet to be on a hackathon team. I'm too busy facilitating or judging. But it doesn't really matter, 'cause I just love watching what everybody does. But so I haven't seen a lot of like hackathons outside of really bio-based things. Like I've gotten a little bit of, you know, I've always come at it from that perspective. When I'm at a hackathon, I'll give some genomics or biology, you know, lecture and then think about things like that. But anyway, that's interesting that there's so many different ways of having this experiential learning in different disciplines. And, it's interesting all the possibilities.
Yeah, and I think one thing we're going to talk about, you know, during the main podcast with Courtney is this concept of training in conjunction with the hackathon and trying to, you know, build some skills. And like you said, you know, create a almost a bridge from training to career through research. Biohackathons can be research oriented as ours are. And yeah. I know you have a couple more biohackathons coming up this summer. Yeah. Praxis AI, look, you know, advertisement, check out hackers.bio. I think there's some stuff coming up in July and August. So, you know, sign up, they're free. It's a wonderful opportunity to collaborate with really smart people, learn new skills, get access to democratized cloud computing, and mm-hmm. hopefully get your name on a published paper, make yes. some, you know, make some inroads into solving some of these big knotty problems.
Yeah, it's a highlight that we're focusing on workforce skills. So even if you don't solve the problem or, you know, whatever happens, you'll still get, if you complete some of the pre-skilling, then you'll get a digital badge which is very valuable for,
fantastic, for
your career. So that's we're always trying to be as practical as possible at Praxis AI.
So without any further ado, let's bring in our guest of honor, Courtney Shearer. Hey, biohackers, welcome back. We're here with Courtney Shearer, our guest for today. How you doing today, Courtney?
I'm doing great. It's nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining the Biohacker Podcast. We're really excited today to talk to you about biohackathons and all sorts of other rabbit holes. One thing we like to do here at the podcast is go down rabbit holes. Alex, why don't you introduce Courtney to all of us?
Yeah, so Courtney is somebody I met as an undergraduate at Clemson, actually as a freshman. I met her a long time ago, and I let her give her professional path, but she's gone through the private sector in biotech and now is actually in a PhD program. So she's seen a lot of different things. So I introduced Courtney as a Renaissance woman, a person who's multidisciplinary and has very, very intriguing views of the world.
Wow. Nice. What an introduction. Oh my goodness. Courtney, how do you follow that up? So tell us a little bit about this transition that Alex just described. You were an undergraduate at Clemson. We're all very curious, as we've been talking to some of Alex's former students, you know, what that experience was like. And then transitioned into industry, biotech, and then back into academia, what that was like over the last few years.
Yeah, so I mean, it's been a big journey, definitely, a bit of a roller coaster. I'll speak to, like, I can kind of divide this up into three main segments, basically my time at Clemson, my time in industry, and then my short time. I'm only just now finishing my first year in my PhD. But to start at Clemson, I absolutely love Clemson. Beautiful, beautiful place. I'm a resident of South Carolina, and I just loved all of the people, and the professors were always just very warm and kind and inspiring. And then from like an academic perspective, I did my training in computer science and I minored in genetics, and I kind of came into undergrad wanting to do computer science almost as this not knowing what I wanted to do, actually. And I figured with computer science, I could gain some practical skills and then figure out what problems I wanted to solve later. So at that time, I actually have an older sibling named Alyssa, and she had just completed a course, bioinformatics, with Dr. Feltus, and she was advising me, oh, you should talk to this guy. You seem to have an interest in biology, and your technical skills could be quite practical. So I spoke to Feltus. I probably just set up a meeting and just told him I wanted to start coming to meetings, lab meetings, and seeing if I could do some biology, and he was always very encouraging. The lab was, I believe, a bit small at that time when I started as a freshman, or at least it got bigger, it felt like, throughout the 4 years I worked with Feltus at Clemson. And I got to be exposed to a wide variety of projects, both from like the data science side of bioinformatics, pure bioinformatics analysis, and even like software engineering. And then like throughout my time there, I ended up collaborating with another professor, Dr. Melissa Smith, that had some collaborations with Feltus already, and we got to kind of incorporate some more machine learning expertise into the lab, and things just got really exciting. And I could confidently say, like, my training with Dr. Feltes, like, gave me, like, a very broad view of, like, all the different ways I could apply my informatics skills to biology. So when it came time to graduate, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do a PhD in, so I decided to kind of pause that. I didn't feel like that excited about the prospect of like going after like one problem, nor did I feel like I had the breadth from like a broader problems in society to kind of know what I wanted to tackle. So I decided to, I knew I wanted to go more into tech. So I moved to California and I was working in the Bay Area at a material science startup named Zymergen. And there I learned a lot more about bioinformatics from kind of more of the microbiology perspective, which was completely new to me, having worked mainly in like human disease and cancer with Dr. Feltes. And then after that, I moved. I was only there for a year because of difficulties in the pandemic. And then I moved to where I am now, to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I was working for a prominent therapeutics company, CRISPR Therapeutics, learning a lot about CRISPR biology, which again was a like a new world for me in terms of assay development and learning about gene editing and therapeutics more broadly. And this kind of set me up with not only an appreciation for like the different problems that are prominent in biology, from like therapeutics to like materials development, but it also built in me or instilled in me a lot of confidence moving into my PhD. And my PhD so far has just been a lot of fun, kind of getting to do rotations, which is what you do in the US. I've even dabbled a little bit in some wet lab, though not very adept there, being more of a computationalist. And I settled on a protein engineering lab with Professor Deborah Marks to work for my thesis.
Wow, what a ride. Like you said, a roller coaster.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's exciting. You know, CRISPR, I'm here in the Bay Area, went to Berkeley. You know, that whole discovery, and then now the creation of the company and some of the really amazing applications of that technology. That's a whole podcast in and of itself.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll definitely explore that subject with you in the future. But pretty exciting transition, again, moving from undergraduate to industry. And you did some really interesting work in industry. Fortunate that you were able to get in, you know, get on with these really exceptional companies early in your career, and then realize, okay, you know, maybe I want to explore something a little bit more specific, go deep in one particular area. Like you said, is it protein engineering?
Yeah, that's like, protein design, sequence design.
Fantastic.
Is that what you want to do, or is that just a really good lab, a good project for you to get your training in?
Well, I think like that's one of the specialties of Debbie's lab, but she is really a champion of tackling some of the hardest problems in environmental health and human health. And I think under her, I will be able to like figure out exactly what I want to do. This summer, I'm planning to kind of explore some different projects in the lab in more depth and try to figure out what I want to do my thesis on. But the lab is amazing in terms of the expertise from different postdocs and other graduate students.
So let me ask it in a different way then. Do you feel like you're figuring out what you want to do for your like scientific career, or he's just getting started and it's a great foundation?
I think I'm still in a little bit of an exploratory phase. Like I've narrowed it down some. Like I want to do sequence design with Debbie, using like basically to get more technical, like machine learning to design and uncover new potential sequences, whether that be protein sequences or RNA sequences that maybe weren't as obviously presented by nature itself. And I think this is a very unique perspective that computationalists can give to experimental biologists as a consideration when conducting larger experimental screens. And I feel like this is like a very attractive thing that I can start to develop expertise in. And I think that is the way that a lot of these initiatives will start to move. Instead of just like kind of rationally trying single edit mutations, can we offer suggestions from the basically the broad knowledge of evolution in terms of all sequences across species to offer suggestions for perturbations that you might want to try in your experiments?
Does that have any like practical applications in medicine or some other field?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly practical in the sense that you can literally design these sequences and synthesize them and then actually test them in a high throughput fashion and see if you can get drug targets for further like clinical development. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds really close to the Praxis mission of, you know, applying data, humans, and technology together to solve some of the world's biggest problems. And I love how you phrased it, Courtney, that, you know, you're attracted to Deborah's lab because she's trying to, you know, tackle some of the toughest challenges. And those, you know, those are the ones where you can use a community of biohackers. You can use the technology and skills, the computational technology and skills that we're starting to develop together. And then apply it with machine learning and some of these new breakthroughs. Wow. I mean, what a cool soup that you're creating. It's gonna be interesting to see, you know, what comes out of it. So we talked earlier about the biohackathon as a nice bridge from, you know, education to career and helping you apply some of the cool technologies and solving, you know, problems in a very concentrated, collaborative way. Tell us the role of the hackathon, because I know you've been a big proponent of the hackathon as a model, and it could be even a new learning model. But talk about hackathon's role in that progression.
And maybe even before, just kind of define what you think a hackathon is.
Yeah, good question.
I think like I was actually thinking about what a hackathon means to me a little bit more and preparation for this conversation. And I'll say first, like what I thought it was, which was simply a really fun, long event where you get together with really excited, smart peers and you have an idea. It could be anything, small, big, whatever, and work on it for a devoted amount of time, potentially not sleeping, definitely eating pizza, and maybe losing your mind a little bit. And that's kind of what a hackathon was to me in undergrad. And I went to a lot of hackathons. I think one hackathon, I rode a bus from Georgia Tech to Michigan for 36 hours to then attend a 36-hour hackathon to then ride a bus for 36 hours back to back home. And I was obsessed, like truly obsessed and enthralled by this idea of just like really grinding out these ideas and having so much fun and meeting people. Now, given this was when I was like in my late teens, early 20s, I don't know that this is a sustainable model for anyone, but I still think a lot of that same energy, if you can capture that, like that is what a hackathon is, that excitement, that like idea of like, oh, I can do anything and I don't have to do it alone. Like I have fun peers to talk to. Maybe they're new peers. Maybe it's just meeting people. And that really is, I believe, the spirit of what education should be. It should be boundless. It should be super fun and it should be collaborative, like from the beginning, not like when you're a PhD or whatever, like it should be that way from, I don't know, from the beginning, from when you're a child, I think it should be like that. So as soon as I saw hackathons were like a way for me to experience these types of environment, I definitely became a bit obsessed with them. And I wanted it at Clemson in undergrad so bad that I just made one myself so that my peers could experience this as well. And I think that is one of my most, it's a very fun experience. And one of my proudest achievements personally was creating this hackathon and having, now that I've left Clemson, it's persisted for multiple seasons. And I know people, it's not really about me at all, but getting to look back and see all of the cool projects, I'll always go to the pages and look at them, even though I'm like an old person now. So yeah. I can't.
Well, you're a, yeah. It's a legacy. I mean, the CU Hackett is a legacy. I mean, you left something, you know, you created something from nothing and left it behind for others to, you know, carry on. So congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. It's a reward in itself just to see. I mean, when I was there, I was more intimately, I would see like students come that were freshmen and see them by the time I left being just so much more confident, but not just confident, but excited and like, I don't know, collaborative. Like I felt like when I was at Clemson, at least something that disgruntled me in my first few years is I felt very alone and that I didn't. Like, academically speaking, I felt very alone and I felt like I was just like working on my homework or working on projects and it wasn't very fun. It was just like, just get the assignment done, be done, and then forget about it forever. It's not very fun. But I think like this idea of like project-based learning and having it be less of like a individual exam and having people really work together, just any class I had, that had projects or hackathons, those taught me the most relevant skills for industry, I think. And like coming back, I think your PhD is it still has a different structure, obviously, than undergraduate training, in that you're kind of out there fighting on your own and trying to figure out what you want to do and what problems you want to solve and how you cannot maybe deliver impact on like a local corporate level, but how can I deliver impact on a larger level? How can I, how can I find these types of problems, which is a bit more, troubling sometimes, but yeah.
Challenging at least.
Challenging. Yeah.
So those problems, like, and I keep hearing like, you know, collaborative and I'm hearing like, you know, project team-based stuff, right? Like, and is that something that, I mean, actually, go to your dissertation. I tell people when they're writing their dissertation to make sure they use the pronoun I, so that they claim it, they own it. And that's the only time I ever tell people to do that. But then it's like, you know, is that even right? Like, their dissertations, they're almost always collaborative now, right? When you're, especially when you're doing biology, but then we claim it as our own. And is that like kind of a natural? I mean, do you crave the collaborative and teamwork to get things done, or?
Yeah.
You know, like, what is it? Like,
that's a really good question. I would say I still think about this often. I don't maybe have a solidified answer. I think it's important to have work that is purely your own, but never oversell it, I guess. Like, you can create something yourself inside the larger context of working with other people and, like, give credit where credit's due, like, say what people did. But, like, I think there is value, at least in the PhD, in my opinion, to like have something that you are really diving into, because it just teaches you so much about the problem. I think of that more as like a scientific, personal pursuit. But I think that is satisfying like a different educational, goal in some way, just of like struggling with like an intellectual problem on your own. But, yeah, I think like it's still very important to come out. Like, you don't have to do science in a vacuum, you know, like you still can like collaborate with people. But I think it is important for individuals to kind of like develop that deep, deep expertise as well.
And so how much of it, like, this is really, really complicated and subtle things too, I think. But like, when you say collaborative and from a bioscientist perspective, right? How much of that means interdisciplinary? Like, because so many problems, really can't learn everything on our own now, right? We can't like go and get 5 PhDs so then we can go do it ourselves. Like, we're always going to have that teamwork. And is collaborative and interdisciplinary, are they intertwined concepts for a hackathon? Or, you know,
I mean, I think they are intertwined concepts potentially in a hackathon. It just depends on what problem, I suppose, you're working on for that to be more concrete. I think hackathons, if you're in certain contexts, you're trying to solve really problems that require multiple levels of expertise. Perhaps that's like a deep biological knowledge, a deep like mathematical knowledge, deep physical knowledge. Like, unless you have found the person who has gotten three PhDs and they're sitting there, which is quite rare, if not impossible, we don't have time. Like, it comes down to it. Like, yeah. I just don't have time to, and it's not like a matter of like laziness or something. It's just like people are dying. The earth is not doing well. Like, we need to like sit down and, or stand up, whatever, and collaborate and with each other and just
figure
like,
it out now.
And figure it out now. And I just don't have time to like not ask questions from people who are the masters. Like, why there's no shame or anything and like, oh, you don't know this idea. It's just like, you move so much quicker, you solve problems so much faster if you just like, and it's more fun. I would argue it's way more fun to interact and engage with other people, and you learn so much more. So I truly believe science should be, or will be, interdisciplinary in the future if we're going to solve big problems.
That's a big part of the biohacker community, is trying to make it as interdisciplinary as possible. And that brings us to this conversation we had earlier, Courtney, about, you know, this spectrum. You had described a spectrum. I'd like you to maybe dig into that subject a little bit about, you know, the computational side and the biological side, you know, of being a computational biologist. You know, we can think of it as wet lab, dry lab, you know, whatever it is, science, computer science. But I've been fascinated. It's, you know, I had the same kind of upbringing as you, many years earlier. But, you know, did the computer science route, got a degree in genetics, did biotech, went and got an MBA, and ended up at Disney. So you have a really interesting future ahead of you. You're going to get a PhD and then go work for Disney.
Doesn't sound so bad.
Yeah, I know. It was a wild ride. But there was always this kind of yin and yang going on in my mind behind, you know, the science and the computation side. Things have gotten way more sophisticated now and more specialized, as we were just talking about. You know, people really are siloing their, you know, and going deep in a very specific subject. So how does a computational biologist deal with that?
To rephrase your question, you mean grappling with like the like kind of diverse skills that you need to tackle these problems, like being on the spectrum?
Yes, the spectrum, exactly.
Well, I'm not going to sit here and tell you, I've thought about this a lot, like, oh, would I recommend somebody to do a computer science degree? Would I recommend somebody to do a biology degree and then do this and then do this? And everybody kind of like wants you to describe this very linear, like kind of progression to get to some like checkpoint. Oh, okay, I'm a computational biologist. Great. I think personally, you should, from like a learning perspective, you should be learning some biology and some computer science at the same time. And I felt like the points that I enjoyed the most in my education and in my work now are points where I'm getting to use all parts of my brain in some sense, but also feel them stretch. I want my computational brain to stretch, and I want my biology brain to stretch. And I imagine a future Courtney perhaps will have like a less like siloed brain. It will all just kind of be like kind of blended together. But I guess right now I still call myself more of a computationalist than a biologist, but I think I'm slowly like kind of moving closer to that midpoint, I guess, of the spectrum is maybe my goal by the end of the PhD. But I guess what I'm saying is, I would recommend people to just do projects that involve both sides. I think like that's way more fun than being like, oh, I need to go do this tutorial on this thing, or I need to go read 5 chapters in my cell biology book or something. Like, as you realize you have holes in your knowledge, fill them in, and it would be much more motivated and fun if you do things that way. Like, I sometimes go in rabbit holes and I'm just somewhere, I don't know, reading a math textbook or something. I'm like, and I sit there and I'm like, wow, that was interesting use of my time, because I'm probably not going to remember it, to be honest, like, yeah. unless it's like in my brain, like woven into a particular project that I was really excited about. And I do think like people also really like to tell stories. And I think our memory likes to exist in stories. So if we have a very nice story around like how we learned some math, some CS, some engineering, some biology, genetics, and it's just all nice wrapped up in our brains, well, we'll remember it and learn it a lot better. And where that is on the spectrum, I'm not so sure. This is kind of just like a vague analogy, this spectrum. But I wouldn't obsess about it too much. I would just get some basic skills, get going, get excited, and start learning.
So if you go back, is the hackathon the tool to do these things? Like, because it's difficult to get exposed to other fields when you're not in the field, and you have to be, you know, at a scientific convention or, you know, some kind of interdisciplinary thing. Because, I mean, like, you don't really know what you don't know, especially when it's outside your field. Like, you could become you are, I'm sure, already well on your way to be an expert in computer science and biology. But then if you need math, you need to be a mathematician for some problem you're trying to solve, right? You know, you need that. Like, you're not going to go get another PhD. And so to expose yourself to that discipline that you're not really good at, I mean, is the hackathon the model, or is it, you know, just finding somebody and collaborating one-on-one? Or like, what's different about the hackathon? Other, you know, you're talking about it being fun, which I totally agree, and creative, you know, but is it something different than the way, is it different than everything else, the hackathon?
Maybe I'll come back to it being different than everything else, but I do think what it is, like I said, it's a fun way to, I think, meet people and potentially, if you want to look at it from like beyond like undergrad education standpoint, it's a good way to like network in some sense, but like form like deeper connections. Like, I feel like a lot of times collaborations are deep scientific or computational collaborations almost feel to me like they're reserved for like people in their PhDs or, I don't know, people in this specific awesome research community at this company or something. But I think hackathons can offer people just, it almost like breaks down the walls, and I don't know if you're allowed to. I mean, the reality is there's like IP and like things like this sometimes around problems. But if you're able to like kind of find a more of like an open source data set or just open source code to work on and learn from, I think that can be really fruitful. And I see like more of these hackathons, even at like, I see conferences will have hackathons too. And I'm not sure what like the barrier of entry is for those. It's probably just money, like most things. But I think that's, we're seeing that as kind of maybe a realization that these can be really good for like meeting new people. I don't always know that a hackathon like cures cancer every time, but I like to think that it might be a stepping stone or a spark of some idea or some friendship, or some collaboration that can lead to something more. They also can just get you going. I think sometimes you're kind of in a rut and you're like, I don't know, let me just go to a hackathon. It seems like a fun use of time. They'll feed me. It sounds good. At least that was my perspective sometimes.
Yeah. Pizza and coding. Yay.
Yeah. Yay.
So one thing that Alex has done with the biohackathon that's really exciting is we're, you know, kind of expanding the concept and making it almost a perpetual thing. So, you know, there's what we call the pre-hack, which is about a month before the event itself. And there's a journey available on the Praxis platform, and you can go in and you can learn about the subject matter, whatever it is, cancer transcriptomics. And if you complete the journey, you get a digital badge, which has its own value. And then you attend the event, which is usually a weekend, maybe 55 hours. And then after that, there's these presentations, and then the teams continue meeting weekly afterwards, really with the ultimate goal of producing a paper or some code in a GitHub. That, you know, there is this practical mechanism associated with the, you know, delivery of the IP or the idea or the contribution, because you talked about cancer won't be cured in a biohackathon, but we can make stepping stones, and those mm-hmm. stepping stones, they really only have value if we get them out of our own heads and into some distribution mechanism, whether it's GitHub or a paper or whatever. And it's got to be open source, so that other people can build on that. And the other thing that's interesting, and I'd like to get your take on the platform, is, you know, the virtual hackathon, your 36-hour bus ride to Michigan and back, just stunning. but, you know, they have fabulous pizza, you know, in the Midwest. So that must have been a nice deep dish pizza. But but you can do so much more virtually. And so the use of a Discord or some sort of, you know, it's a gaming platform collaboration environment, then allows people to come together virtually, have that event, but then continue to collaborate virtually. What do you make of all that? What kind of platforms were you using?
I feel like a lot of this like virtual hackathons kind of came about, and maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like it came about as like a product of the pandemic and people still wanted to have these hackathons and, have the same energy. I think the hackathon I started, CU Hackit, had a virtual, at least one, maybe two virtual years. I think those are great. I think I shouldn't have to get on a bus. Honestly, I got sick after that bus ride because I was like cramped on the floor of a bus, and like that was not fun. So I would much rather have done that virtually. I think sometimes there is a lot of value in having them be in person, though. I don't think virtual is like the thing to do 100%, but I think a mix is probably good. I think also having it virtual allows for more participation from people mm-hmm. who otherwise might not have been able to join. Like a 36-hour mm-hmm. bus ride you can do it. It sucks. You can do it, but there's some people that are not going to be able to fly across the world for your hackathon. So getting mm-hmm. to really collaborate with like everyone, like globally, is a truly awesome benefit of having these virtual hackathons, which I would say is quite attractive for having them.
Yeah, we need to figure out some sort of like augmented reality way of stacking cups. Some of the events and hackathons are fun. You know, the face to face, there's nothing better than meeting together for anything, right? But we wanted to keep it virtual, even though it's not the optimal way, to make it democratized, because like that bus ticket, a lot of people couldn't afford, right? And just like, there's so many people out there that their brains are waiting to be unlocked, and I want to get them unlocked, you know, for free, you know, subsidize it. This stuff is, you know, nothing's free when it comes to data intensive computing, like we do with a lot of genomics work. But I really want that, you know, the rural, you know, student who just doesn't have access to things to be able to really to do it. But it would be nice if there was, you could just get on a plane for free, right, and go anywhere you want. If we lived in a world like that, that would be ideal.
Star Trek. Yeah. Or Harry Potter, just to you know, to bring up another term. So tell me, Courtney, what's one of your favorite hackathon experiences?
I mean, I would say my favorite experience was directing a hackathon for me personally, just getting to see it from that point of view. Like, I never appreciated as a participant how much time and energy and effort went into the hackathon, but I personally just experienced so much joy, like seeing, like, you know, the hackathon begins. If it's in person, it's very visual. So you see all these like nervous, kind of like sleepy people walk up to this building, trusting you for a fun weekend or whatnot. And then at the end, you see these like kind of hungry, deranged, also sleepy people like presenting something they have so much excitement about because they owned it, they created it, and they saw it through. And for me, that was like, I mean, I don't even think people who participate in hackathons always get to see that perspective. And that was just really, really awesome. And made it all worth it, like all the months and months of effort worth it. And then also seeing like for me, from like, I guess more of like a pseudo like managerial perspective, seeing like the confidence of like the people I was managing to run the hackathon just blossom and grow and see them gain confidence in their ability to lead people and to like drive innovation and drive collaboration was just really, really special to me.
Great answer. Alex, how about you? Tell us one of your favorite hackathon experiences.
My favorite hackathon experience is, I'm waiting for a moment to say this. So like a lot of what we're doing is built from my experience with CU Hackit and how transformative it was and how much better of a professor like you and the CU Hackit team were than me as a professor. Do you know what I mean? Like it was just so much, I don't know, like pre-synergistic, like just built in. Absolutely amazing. But when I didn't really understand what a hackathon was until I started judging it, right? I think I judged probably the first CU Hackit. Mm-hmm. You know, as the professor comes in and listens to some teams, you get five teams and see what they built. And I was floored by what these people built, not so much the final product, but the process they went through in such a short period of time, where you'd see, like, I remember, like, maybe not CU Hackit, but the Hello World, you know, freshman hackathon was one of the most amazing experiences to me. Was going up to a team of 18-year-olds, and they built like a really cool website, and you know they had hooked up to an API and did all this really, really fantastic stuff. And then I always grill the team on what their skills were before they started. This thing was like really pretty sophisticated Python based project. None of them knew Python. Wow. Before. And I remember Ben Sheely, Ben Sheely at the time, was one of the mentors with that. And he was, you know, I got to talk to the mentor and how he was helping them learn how to do these things. And so like, I saw like this, the mentor, the, you know, the best way to learn is to teach, like go through the roof, mentorship, the leadership of being able to, you know, manage that. And then the skills that were just, you know, sponged up, like the sponge is about to explode in 24-hour period. And I saw this and I'm like, I see little bits and pieces of how I train people in my lab. And I'm like, well, can you scale up the training when you build this kind of learning environment around something that matters, right? Like a patient or, you know, some aspect of, you know, climate change or any of these massive complex problems that we have. And it just feels like everything in me makes me think that This is the transition of our species. If we started learning this way, maybe not just like pure hackathon, but just really weaving it into how we learn, as opposed to sitting at your desk and reading how many chapters of Cell Biology's book you say. I remember doing stuff like that and loving it, but I remember always feeling really inhibited or limited by what I was, by just my own. I only had one brain on the problem. Mm-hmm. And if I'm sitting there studying with five other people, like what would come out of that, right? But they have to be compatible. You have to be friends or compatible people, right? You have to have the right personality mix to make it work. So, but anyway, I just said the hackathon, the CU Hackit was definitely that helped me transition from kind of an old school way of teaching and learning to a new way. And thank you.
But yep.
And I would say, you know, David, so what was your favorite hackathon experience? Oh, well, thank you.
So David, what was your favorite hackathon experience?
So it was very recently, Passman Meharry biohackathon, yeah, you know, that we just had in April. And it was focusing in on the patient, Bill Passman, who led his own team. And you just described something really interesting. I think you coined a term like train hackathon or hack a train-a-thon or something like that, where
skillathon, I think.
Skillathon, yeah. Right. But this idea that you could also learn, right? Yeah. We call it the pre-hack, but you know, you're learning. So Bill comes into this going, okay, I need some computational skills in order to truly understand what's going on, you know, with his rare kidney cancer, but also now, you know, suddenly this tumor arising in his brain, and are they related? And, you know, what's the manifestation of, you know, different markers. So, you know, he was able to go through the journey, and we would meet with him weekly before the hackathon, and he was learning some key tools. You talk about the Python, you know, the students learning Python to build their website. And then in that 55-hour hackathon, he was more skilled and prepared to actually apply what he had learned to a real hypothesis. His team came up with one. He did this really cool presentation. And then, you know, he's been in all of the office hours, the weekly office hours since then. You know, you mentioned, you know, Reed Bender has been, we did a podcast with him about chaos theory. And so that kind of got Bill Passman excited. And now he's integrating some of Reed's theories, you know, around that. So it's truly a collaboration and an opportunity to learn in a very unique way. And just to be able to watch that, you know, I have a degree in genetics and I didn't know half of what people were saying. And it was so exciting because of the, you know, the nature of creativity and being able to see it, people ideate right in front of me. Mm-hmm. That was exciting. So anything else? Is there anything we've left off, Alex or Courtney, that you wanted to talk about?
Do you feel like you know where you're going to go? You know, after your PhD, do you have a plan, or is it still like, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up? Because I feel that I'm in my 50s and I still don't really know what I'm going to do when I grow up.
I think I actively try to kind of fight against like knowing what I'll do when I grow up, I guess. Like, I'm very anti that because I think it's better. Like, you maybe have some kind of like, oh, what am I doing right now? I'm trying to finish my PhD. I'm trying to figure out what problems I want to work on my PhD. I think that's sufficiently complex for now. I'm not really that concerned with what I do after. I just know how I want to feel. Is mainly what I think about, not what I want to like have like an accolade or specific thing. I want to feel like every day excited, or most days excited, when I wake up to go to work on whatever I'm working on, to get to work with whomever I'm working with, and to get to work on problems that I think are truly meaningful and will help human health and help us with battling some of the problems with our planet right now. And I think that's about that. That is kind of maybe the only thing I think about, is just I want to always feel excited about what I'm working on.
That's great.
Yeah, I see that. Everybody, I see that in so many people, that there's more people I've noticed are saying, I want to do something that makes a difference, and not just like, how much money can I make? Right. And those two things can go together, I think, but it's so important. I mean, cause you know, it's motivating, right? That's one thing I love about the hackathons. When you bring real data to it, like a patient data set or something like that, that it has meaning to people. They know they're helping somebody, and it's just so much better to learn while you're helping somebody then learn and then help somebody. Like, to me, it just almost doesn't make sense anymore, the way we abstract and things so much.
So let me ask you, Courtney, one of the last questions we like to always ask our guests is, you know, this is the Biohacker podcast. You're one of the original biohackers. Thank you very much. So what is a biohacker to you? And do you have any advice for our friends out there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I suppose a biohacker to me is somewhat like a regular hacker, except you are focused on biological problems. And I would hope that a biohacker is focused on biological problems for good. Mm-hmm. What was the second part of your question?
Any advice to the biohackers? I think you've given a lot of good advice, you know, kind of might transitional, you know, career advice, but anything else, any other advice?
Yeah. I mean, I think like, not shockingly, my advice would be to always have fun. I think that if you have excitement and energy towards what you're working on, you'll be just that much more motivated to keep working on it and follow it through. And kind of even sometimes, like, even if the problem seems big and scary for whatever reason, you think you don't know this, you don't have this skill. Well, go find the person to teach you that skill, and like really focus on seeing it be a success, even to the point where maybe it seems a bit irrational to think it will be a success, and that will carry you through to some version of success by the end. And to also, in a more practical note, find good mentors as well. Like, I think people are more willing than you think. They'd be like, oh, I don't want to talk to this kid. People love to talk to, like, not everybody, but there's a lot of, like, awesome people out there, especially in this space, that they just want to, like, teach the next generation, perhaps, or it doesn't even have to be a youth thing, like, teach anybody at any age, relevant information to help them advance progress on very real and important problems in biology. So don't be shy.
Great advice. And you know what I love is I love the word fun, and you use that word a lot today. So the last question is going to be, what are you doing these days for fun? Tell us something fun, something surprising that you're doing for fun.
I think for fun right now, I've been a runner since I was about 12 years old. So I'm trying to run a lot more and not just run for fun. I've been listening to Harry Potter while I've been running, which is kind of nice. So that's been really fun for the summer. And then I'm also just trying to, like, whenever I read papers and things, I mean, I am a PhD student, so that takes up the bulk of my time is, like, learning and reading, which I find to be really, really fun. When I read a paper, try to have fun with it, like, enjoy it. I'm just trying to, like, enjoy everything I do a bit more. And I think there is, like, some nice symmetry there, or a nice metaphor with, like, running. Like, once you get running, it can almost be kind of fun, and you're just kind of flowing through it. And, like, sure, like, some days are really, really hot, and you're really, really tired. But, like, just run through that day. Maybe tomorrow will be better. And try to have fun even when it's, like, when it's difficult. So I'm just trying to, not wait for any particular, like, milestone in my life to start, like, to be happy and enjoying, like, the process. It's just, like, enjoy now. So that's just what I'm trying to do, I guess.
Enjoy the process. That's great advice.
Yeah.
They say that some of the best performers are the ones that enjoy the practice and rehearsals more than the performance. So that's great advice. Well, thank you so much, Courtney. It was a real pleasure having you on the show. And we look forward to connecting with you again soon. Cue the closing theme.